This is Sophie Grant interviewing Fatina Cummings for the No Fit State Oral History Archive Project. Can you tell me how you first got involved with No Fit State?
I first got to know about No Fit State through Liz Lavender, who was general cook, bar and first aid appointee. I went to the juggling convention with my daughter Blaise in 1996 in Cardiff, where I got to meet formally most of the long-term riggers and cast of No Fit State.
Can you tell me what role you played in the circus?
Eventually I played the role as catering manager to oversee and the running of the operations of the kitchen.
Can you tell me why the kitchen's important when you're on tour?
The kitchen has been probably the most versatile space, which is the hub of the circus, where it's the place to debrief, the place to bring conflict, and also about keeping the mind and the soul sort of connected and grounded. It's like the reality of No Fit State sort of thing. And it's also the first point of contact for most people. So anybody looking for somebody, anybody with a health issue, and also as backup support for all the other parts, so like the bar or the front of house. So it's always, I don't know if it's ever been really considered a hub, but I, you know, felt that I've dealt with many tasks apart from cooking.
Right. Liz says you've been on a lot of journeys, and if there's any stories you could tell me.
Oh, there's lots of stories of journeys.
Tell me a few.
When I first joined the circus, it would have been, I think, 2003 of the Immortal Tour. What had happened was, I'd obviously got to know No Fit State in 1996 when my daughter first learned to ride the unicycle, because it was the safest place, was the tennis court. She stayed there and learnt it. And then it was over the years that I got to know more about the riggers and the whole show and just the whole backstage of how it ran. I used to visit Liz quite a lot. So when I first joined No Fit State, I didn't have a vehicle. I'd just left my husband and I didn't even know how to tow a caravan. So I had a caravan and I was given a small sort of truck from Ali gave me her blue Dodge van, very, very cheap price, so that I could work. And it was just learning generally about the lifestyle of living on the road. I've had many journeys. The cat used to travel with us as well. The cat started travelling with us, I think it would have been 2004, because we didn't have anybody to look after her. And so we took her on the Irish tour. I got on the first block. I think I then got to the second block. And moving from the second block to the third block, I lost my van on just before Limerick, on the outskirts of Limerick. That was a bit of a journey, being accosted by gypsies who literally would have stripped my van in front of my eyes as they spoke to me. And then luckily pulling down the road and parking up in a travel lodge where they were really nice to me because of the cat. And on one side you would see the kitchen trailer and the van, and then the other side I was ripping everything out, so I had to leave that vehicle. There's been many of journeys. There's been one journey where we left, I don't know if it was London to, I think it was from the Roundhouse to Manchester, where I was pulled over by the police because of a dodgy light, lost the convoy, managed to get back into the convoy and get a bit lost again, and then lost the caravan, went to pull up, was like, where's my caravan? Looked in the mirror, there was no caravan. That was an epic journey. That was, the cat ran away at the service station, Blaze fell down a manhole, with one leg out, so it saved her going all the way down, and then lost the caravan. It rolled, I don't know how it didn't to wipe out everything, but it just managed to roll and sort of park itself without crashing into anything. This was at like 5 in the morning, and then the police found it, then they wouldn't let me take it home, then it was towed away. And then life goes on, you still have to get up at 8 in the morning to start prepping. It doesn't stop, you still have to keep working. There's been many a journeys. We've been on journeys, me and Liz. Me and Liz used to convoy a lot, and she used to drive. The first year, she drove the bus, and there's no power steering on these old coaches. And I think the fastest it went was 39 miles an hour. And that was on a good stretch. And I think the windscreen wipers broke on that one. So we've done nose-to-nose driving, one leading the other. There's been lots of journeys. I bought a... I had to drive from... I'm trying to remember where. We had to drive from one of the stands, and my windscreen wipers broke down, but we couldn't stop driving because we had a flight to catch, so we had to park up the vehicles. I think that was actually the year. Yeah, that was the year of disaster travelling, where I'd lost the caravan, then I'd bought a large truck. And yeah, I think I have probably most of the epic journeys, but I always still manage to arrive on time. Not too often have I been late. But yeah, we've had many a journeys, not after coming back from Limerick and not having a van. The circus done a big collection. I didn't know they'd been doing this collection for about a month, and everybody just kept on chucking in money, and I went and bought, and I asked for something large on the driving license, and the truck driver John Ashton had arranged for a friend in Wolverhampton to sell me a vehicle, and I got there and the vehicle was like 26 foot long. I'd never driven anything like that. I'd never driven hydraulic brakes. Luckily, the man who I bought it off, which I had to buy it because I had nothing to live in and that was the deal, he was a HGV training instructor. So he gave me an hour's lesson free, which was, you'd probably look back on it and say it was really dangerous. Got on the motorway, drove to Birmingham, showed my mates, because I come from Birmingham. Drove back on the motorway, ended up in traffic, and then broke down. So the guys who I bought the truck off, they arranged for the highwaymen to tow it back down to a safer junction. Paid the bill for me as well, and then we went back to their yard and they found out what the problem was. There was a little hole in the leak for the pipe from the fuel tank to the engine, so that's why it wasn't running. So I got back in the lorry, and considering that I'd never ever driven one of these things before, I had to drive from Wolverhampton to Edinburgh and be on Leaf Lane before 8 o'clock for the tent up. I managed to do it. I managed to find my way around Edinburgh with no maps and a big truck from memory. And that was a year later. And parked my truck up and being there, and I'd just bought it. Hadn't even seen what it looked like inside. But I think my first bit of furniture was a dresser, which was on one of the streets where the band had been playing at. We used the big Mercedes. So they used to call it the Palace because it had like proper regal furniture in it. So that's one of the journeys. So yeah, now I drive quite large vehicles and have really good driving skills. I can jump into any vehicle now and drive. And that's from living on the road with no fit state. So yeah, lots of driving stories.
Have you got any negative memories of working with the company? Any times that were really
difficult? Yeah, I think I worked too alone for too long. It can be, it's like romance, and the beauty of romance is the heartache. And I think you can view the relationship with the circus as a romance. Some people do. There were also the impact it has on the individuals and their lives can be very trying, and you almost wonder why you choose to do it, because, you know, the risk what people take and the cost on people's lives. I think the bad memory for me was that I used to start work a lot earlier before everybody else. And that was probably one of the reasons why I had to stop working as a touring chef, was the amount of responsibility. You take things for granted when you work in society. You have deliveries, you have built kitchens, you have contingency plans. When you're on the road, you're just trusting all the elements. So I think my biggest, bad feeling about No Fit State was I'd worked on my own for so long that it took me a long time to overcome working again with people. That's probably been the biggest impact on me.
What do you do now? Do you still do anything with No Fit State? Or?
Yeah, well, my daughter's heavily involved in No Fit State. I don't see No Fit State as a company or a romance. It's a way of life. The support, what I've received from many different people, and especially the founders, I feel that if anything happens in my life, they would probably be the first people I'd contact, because I don't come from a big family myself. So I still work on small projects with Elliot from time to time. I may come and cook Christmas dinner for the company. I might even do some voluntary work on the bigger tours if I'm needed to. I go and fill in. Sometimes I still do a bit of cooking now and then. So I don't see that anybody leaves. Some people choose to leave, but I think there's also lots of other things what you can contribute to, because there's all aspects of the company apart from the show which are not visible. I think you're always involved if you keep your relationships running, because it's about the process and how the company processes things. So you may get a call to discuss something, or your opinion may be valued in certain aspects. So I don't think it's ever that you stop working. I think that you have to move on to let things develop and let the family keep growing.
Before we stop, is there any highlights or really good memories that you have working with the company that would be relevant?
Got lots of really good memories. I had really good birthdays with No Fit State. It was great. The skills, what I've developed, what I've had but have never ever been appreciated, have probably been a lot more appreciated with No Fit State. And I think the way that you are encouraged to express and the trust what you were given, it doesn't appear so at the time, but it's I think their free flow attitude enables lots of people to develop, not always for the best, but it's a part of developing and growing. So I think my best memories were the journeys again. Not all the journeys were bad. Sometimes having a break and travelling in the convoy and having that support. I mean, driving a truck around Europe and not having road recovery, but literally just somebody in front and some behind, are really good memories. And seeing all the children what have been born in No Fit State and growing up and evolve, you know, it's really nice. I just hope that there'll be some unity for the younger ones to come later. But I think probably one of the best memories, I think we were talking about this not so long ago, was Torrega, which was the Spanish festival, which is just outside Barcelona. And we were the highlight for the 25th year anniversary. And that was really good for me, because I didn't have to cook, but the company still took me and said they wouldn't leave me, and still paid me. I think it was quite nice to work front of house and change a job and be on holiday and have a really good time. So that was a really good and having the truck, obviously, with the money what they collected for me, that was, you know, really good memory. So I've always got my truck to remind me of the circus.
That's good. Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time to speak to me. It's been really enjoyable hearing some of your stories. The time now is 4:13.
Yeah, I didn't say about Meat Club, did I? Never mind.
Oh no, she wanted to speak about that.
Yeah. I'll quickly touch on some there. What's that journey's Meat Club? Yeah, when I first came and started cooking in the kitchen, it was classed as a vegetarian kitchen, but obviously the company had evolved, and I think because the kitchen was so basic that you couldn't really do it. So I used to cook bits of things, and then what happened was with the travelling, you get to develop your menu from where you're at and what resources you've got and how much you can blag. And some of the guys, I made it a bit of a game, really, and then people started to get really involved in the kitchen. So the blokes would come in, and because people want their favourite dishes, you get more input from them. And one of the guys, Marco, I don't know if you've interviewed him yet, but he's a real meat person, so it was trying to find some kind of balance. So because we didn't want to live on just bad ethical meat, I decided that I'd start a meat club. So Marco was the heavy. He would go around and collect the money. We'd draw up a list, and we used to have meat club twice a week. And it was, people would get really upset if they didn't put their money in. And you sort of realise how much power the kitchen had, because you know, if you wanted to get really good meat portions, it would be like how well you worked in the kitchen. And then if you thought I was favouring the meat eaters too much, the vegetarians would come in and go, well, I'm going to come in and do this. And Meat Club was really, really funny. You used to put a pound in for a portion of extra meat, and we had Diva of the Day, because you always have these dietary requirements. So, because some of the performers can be over, you know, pedantic about their diet, and they used to just, like, come and try and, like, have a go at me. So I just designed this board called Diva of the Day. So whoever had the speciality dish for that day, their name would be put on the board. And it was a great way of toning it down so that they didn't nag me. They sort of brought themselves into check a little bit, and it became more sustainable. But, Meat Club was, you just don't talk about it. It was a big secret. We tried to keep it a secret from Ali for a long time. It was like, there's no meat. But as long as the food was good enough quality for everybody, like the vegan, he's like, it's only because I trust you, he said. That's why I will eat from you, because he knew that I took his food seriously. But, yeah, Meat Club was, it was serious. And that started in 2000. For Meat Club, and it's like, when you know, you're not allowed to talk about it in public, you're not allowed to ask me. It's just the bouncer will go around, he will take your name and he will pick up your money, and it worked really, really well. It kept everybody and then you get people who come and they're like, I didn't hear about Meat Club, where's my mother? You know, if your name's not on the list, you're not in the club. So, yeah, the kitchen did get a little bit of ethos from that. And I don't know if anybody else has tried it again. But what I did know was when I did leave, I couldn't really visit the company because I was just getting like, I can't cope. And so I had to stay away for a couple of years just to let somebody else evolve in the kitchen.
That's understandable.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me to talk about that.
Okay.
The time now is 4:17.
Okay.